is Our American Stories, and we love free enterprise, we love business, and we love Shark Tank. It's a great show. It's number one on television on Friday nights, and it's practically running round the clock on CNBC at night as well, beating the regular programming during the day, by the way. And next up in the tank from this past week is a guy named Martin with his company, SmartPlate. Here's the pitch.
Hi, Sharks. My name is Martin Dell'Archipretti, and I'm from Philadelphia, PA. My company is SmartPlate, and I'm seeking $1 million for a 15% stake in my company. Every day, millions of Americans work hard to maintain a healthier lifestyle. From health-conscious consumers to elite athletes, success comes down to eating smart. The problem is, eating smart with current solutions requires tedious manual calorie counting, which is time-consuming, frustrating, and worst of all, inaccurate. SmartPlate is the world's first intelligent plate that instantly analyzes your entire meal with up to 99% accuracy.
And Alex is doing the math because he knows I'm going to ask him. So let's see, $1 million, 15% stake. What's he pegging the valuation of his business?
I can't do it quite exactly, but it's just shy of $7 million.
Just shy of $7 million. That'll do. That gets him a ding and a bell. So how does the SmartPlate work?
It uses food recognition technology and load sensors to identify and weigh everything sitting on its surface, from single foods to prepared meals like pizza, vegetable fried rice, and even a garden salad. All you have to do is place your food on the plate the way you normally would, and bam, get all your nutritional information in a snap, including calories, carbs, and proteins. Our mission is to get SmartPlate into the hands of every American who wants to improve their health.
Martin passes out some plates and then drops a word that no shark likes to hear, prototype.
Do you have plates there that we can look at?
Yes, yeah, I do.
Like
I'm going
to
hand those out right now. So we have a prototype of our merchandising, and then we also have
a prototype of the SmartPlate.
Thank you. When asked how the plate can differentiate between ingredients used, Martin complicates things.
How does it differentiate fried rice with a certain type of oil and another type of oil? You know,
So oils and things of that nature, we're not going to be able to pick up, but we do have a solution for that. So we give consumers three options. They can either snap it, scan it, or say it. So we have over 350,000 CPG barcodes. If somebody's out at a restaurant, we have a database of restaurant meals as well, over 100,000 restaurant meals.
So I'm from New York City, and here's what we believe. On the eighth day, God made street meat. There's no barcode on the dirty little hot dogs that I eat out there. How's that going
to
help me?
If you take a picture of the hot dog, we'll be able to analyze and identify that it's a hot dog. Then if it was on, you know, the SmartPlate, we'd be able to identify the weight. If you didn't have the SmartPlate, just with your smartphone and the Snap It feature, you'd be able to take a picture. We'd say that it's a hot dog.
I'm thoroughly confused.
The SmartPlate ain't so smart, is what he's saying. When asked to demonstrate, Martin uses his phone rather than the SmartPlate to scan the food.
Martin, can you demonstrate how that app actually works so we get a better feel for it?
I'd love to do that. What's firing right now is the food recognition portion. We don't have the weight sensors in these aesthetic prototypes yet, but I can demonstrate the functionality, if that's okay. We're going to hit Snap It, then we're going to look at our piece of pizza here. We're going to take a picture.
Got it.
And then within seconds, it'll be able to identify it. And there you see it.
I see three cameras there.
Yes.
So talk about those.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because what were you using your phone for if the cameras are all in this, in the plate?
What I was using my phone for was to simulate the cameras.
Oh my goodness, I am lost. How much are they trying to sell these things for?
So it's going to retail for $199.
Oh.
For us, that's a 469%.
Martin, honey, sweetie, poopsie. That's crazy.
Sweetie poopsie. Damon, are you in or out?
I'm uncomfortable with the way that you're making this pitch.
Well, too bad. Then you're in, you're out.
It's
what
a little,
do,
and so I'm out.
Oh, Mr. Wonderful, what about you?
Martin, when I look at how people eat, including myself and my family, I think that people don't eat all their food at home near the SmartPlate. They have lunch at school, they have lunch on the run, they eat in a restaurant at night. You're going to spend a lot of time and money trying to sell these plates to people. And I don't really think they have any merit at all. I'm out.
Ooh, what a slam. But I was thinking the same thing. Cuban?
In or out?
I don't see any technology that you guys introduced. This is a technological product.
Mm-hmm. That's
correct.
You
sold it as such, right?
Yes.
It is. You're trying to sell the value. And what I'm hearing is the value proposition, their core competency, you're hiring from third-party design companies and you're hoping they can make it work.
They're experienced in the space.
What if it doesn't work? You're betting your entire company on some external design company. You guys can't control your own destiny. You have no idea whether or not this stuff is even going to work. That is a huge problem for me. I'm out.
What about guest shark billionaire Chris Sacca?
You're trying to sell people a very expensive, very fragile, hard thing that doesn't fit in their pocket, that can't go with them anywhere, and you're charging a lot of money for it. There are so many different ways this business fails right out of the gate, and for that reason, I'm out.
And Barbara, are you in or out?
Yeah, your presentation really was just terrible. I'm sorry to say, just terrible and confusing. I'm out.
Terrible and confusing.
That was a depressing one.
That was really depressing. It was over by the third clip, I'm telling you. Jesse, thanks for doing that. We love bringing you Shark Tank because in the end, you get to learn a little bit about business. And by the way, this guy was pegging his business at an almost $7 million valuation, and he didn't have a sale.
Not a single one.
He didn't have a single sale. And it's as if the guy had never watched Shark Tank. Because as Alex, what do they always ask?
What are your margins?
What are your margins? Which means you have to have a sale to have a margin of profit. And this is Our American Stories. We love to cover it all. We love the culture. And we love it, particularly when the culture can be this darn entertaining and teach us a few lessons about why the 1%, those billionaires sitting up on the stage, give their money to others to make others a member of the 1% and live the American dream. And these folks don't just want the 1%'s money, of course. They want their wisdom and their experience. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And this is Our American Stories, and we're back with our weekly segment with Nate Scott from For the Win, USA Today's leading sports site at ftw.usatoday.com. And for the last few weeks, we've been talking about basketball, and we're going to do it one more time before shifting to some other of the more interesting things that are on the site, because sometimes there are just some great stories there that have nothing to do with sports, and they're just terrific. But first, we have to talk about the big move. Kevin Durant joining the Golden State Warriors. And boy, there have been some tough responses, Nate, from some of the old pros. What's going on here?
Yeah, you know, Kevin Durant, one of the three best players in the NBA, rose the Oklahoma City Thunder franchise sort of almost single-handedly with some help, decides to leave the team and join the Golden State Warriors, and the old guys are not happy about it.
Well, you know, you note that Charles Barkley said that he's cheating his way to a ring, and of course Reggie Miller said personally values legacy over rings. And I'll tell you what I find appalling. He's taken the Thunder, this great small market team, this far, Nate. They're maybe one player away. They were a couple of shots away from maybe beating Golden State. They played them really tough. Why leave and go to the team that has all the talent when you're maybe one and a half players away from beating them the next year?
And I wrote about that. I actually, you know, argued that Durant owed Oklahoma City and himself one more year there. You know, not just owing a team. He doesn't owe them anything. They have plenty of money regardless.
Right, right.
Owing it to himself and his teammates to sort of go one more year. He could have signed a one-year contract and then gone for a big extension with any team. And I just thought, you know, they were so close. They made a couple off-season moves that I liked. And frankly, I would have picked the Thunder as my preseason favorite if he had returned. Instead, he joins the 73-win Warriors team. I guess he just figured this was his one chance to do it, and he had to seize the opportunity.
But you're going to a team that already has produced rings and almost produced another one. It produced a ring, not rings. Almost produced another one. And so your being there may not be the reason why you're getting the ring. Why would you want that ring?
Yeah, and I think it comes down to legacy. You know, I think right now Durant clearly thinks this is the best way for him to become a better player and to play better basketball. But, man, you know, if he does win, I don't know if his legacy is the same as if he had brought a title to Oklahoma City.
I think that's right. Now, Larry Bird's quote was really interesting. I know back in the day he said, I couldn't imagine going to the Lakers and playing with Magic Johnson. I'd rather try to beat him. But these guys are different, and I understand a lot of it, and it's within the rules, so they can do whatever they want to do. It's not exactly a ringing endorsement from Larry Bird, Nate.
Yeah, but Larry Bird was also playing with Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish.
Oh, that helps.
Johnson, so
that does help.
It helps. It helps.
But, you know, he did wait. I mean, DJ joined the team later. I mean, when Larry Bird got there in 1979, the reason he was such a high draft pick is because the Celtics stunk.
Yep.
And this is the tradition. Michael Jordan gets to Chicago, and the team gets built. Magic Johnson goes to L.A., championships. Bill Walton goes to Portland. I mean, my goodness, who would have ever equated the Portland Trailblazers with being a championship team? This is what greatness is all about. And here is this guy, Kevin Durant, about to possibly bring old Oklahoma City to greatness, and he leaves before it can ever happen.
Yeah, it's a stunning move. And I don't – the NBA is going to be super interesting next year.
Oh, I mean, it's going to be great.
If the Warriors lose more than 8 or 9 games, you know, that season will have to be considered a disappointment. So
you bet.
It works.
You know what can happen, Nate, and you know this, because team chemistry is something special. And you add that one extra ingredient, like in any recipe, and you can actually kill the thing. And everybody thinks this is a no-brainer, adding another shooter and a scorer. But maybe it's not, Nate. What happens if they lose 15 games? Oh, my goodness. What's Durant's legacy then, Nate?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's the thing. You know, I think I've written about this, too. Everyone seems to think it's going to be seamless. Those shots have to come from somewhere. I think they're going to come from Draymond Green, and we have to see if he, you know, he was a big part of their offense last year. Is he comfortable taking a backseat role? You know, And you never know. You never know until the team comes together and see how they react.
That's right. No doubt. And let's talk about the beautiful beast in celebration of Timmy Duncan. And what a career. What a pro. And by the way, what's not to love about this San Antonio team in general and the work that John Popovich did with this team? But, boy, Duncan does not get the credit because he's not glamorous. And there's no slam dunks. And he doesn't, you know, look for attention for himself. But if I had a teammate, I'd want him to be a guy like Timmy Duncan.
He's the best. Tim Duncan retired today. We're recording this on Monday at the age of after 19 seasons in the NBA. And I love how he did it. You know, Kobe Bryant had the farewell season. Every city, they threw a party for him. He had parting gifts. Tim Duncan on a Monday in July announces his retirement. The Spurs are doing a press conference tomorrow about his career, and he's not coming. He's having the team.
I love it.
He's just walking away. You know, he's had enough. He had an incredible career, and he'll have one cold beer tonight and go to bed early.
And that's it.
Tim Duncan is.
Yep. And I've always thought he was the anti-star. That he was the star who didn't want the limelight. He was the star who didn't want the attention. He was the star that didn't like being a star. He just wanted to win and go home.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at his individual stats and think this was a team-first player and he put that career together individually, if he had been trying for his own stats, like the mind reels at what numbers he could have put up. But that wasn't interesting to him.
No, not at all. Not at all. And he also is like one of the centers that just really understood how to pass, how to see the floor, how to surrender the ball to the guards. He just did, well, he just played beautiful and perfect basketball. And now we got to get something to something important, Nate, that we should have gotten to last week. And that's this activity that you covered, a certain kind of dating. It's not speed dating. It's something quite different. Talk about this new kind of dating. Explain it to the folks.
It's called smell dating.
Yep.
Perfect. The thing with smell, you know, I think this website understood, you know, it's a limited thing right now. They're just working with a small group of people. But what they understood is that smell is something that's hard to quantify. It's hard to measure. But people that you love, you tend to be able to tolerate and sort of love the way they smell. So they ask you to wear a shirt without deodorant for 3 days, and you mail it into the people. And then they analyze that and match you with someone to go on a date with. And
I'm going to be sick.
And I don't know if it works yet, but some people think it's a good idea.
Hey, look, this is, you know, maybe I'm going to, my wife's going to kill me when I say this, but my wife has said that smell, because I told her we were doing this segment, and she has told me on any number of occasions that I'm out if I had certain kinds of body odor that disgusted her. She said, you're just, I've kicked to the curb many a guy because of the way they smell. And I'm not so sensitive, but I can't eat food I don't like the smell of.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that it's the sense I think we understand the least. But they say it's tied well to memory. It's tied well to attraction. So you never know. Maybe these people are onto something.
So shipping your sweaty clothes to another person for them to sniff it and then decide whether this date's going to work out. I mean, if this business flies, Nate, I really should never invest in anything because I don't know that this can work. But thanks for bringing it to our attention. And, you know, in the summer doldrums, because a lot of people who don't love baseball, and I this is not a slam on baseball, but for all the folks who love the NFL, who love basketball, who love hockey, you know, what happens in your world during the summer in terms of visits to the website, traffic? Is it up? Is it down? What happens during the hot days of August, particularly in late July?
You know, with the way the NFL and the NBA are now, they're 12-month-a-year sports. With the off-season transactions, with trade rumors, with all that stuff going on, there's no off-season in sports anymore. You know, these are our doldrums, and we're reporting on things happening in and around the league, business decisions. It never stops anymore. Sports, people will find ways to find their sports.
Yeah, it's so true. And with the fantasy football leagues and all the off season jockeying that years ago, no one even knew anything about. It's an all year round activity. And Nate, thanks for joining us. As always, we look forward to catching up with you next week.
Thanks, buddy.
You bet. And there you have it. And you can go to Nate's work and his team's work at ftw.usatoday.com. And read the tribute to Tim Duncan, because it's just terrific. First class guy, first class team, Popovich, the whole crew. As classy a team as I've ever seen in the history of sports. And kudos, Tim, and we're all going to miss you, any of us who love the sport and who love basketball. And this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib. More after these messages. In the next two segments, we're going to be talking to Lenora Skenazy, who's the author of the book and blog Free Range Kids, and we love it. And she's a contributor to Reason.com, another site we adore. And her TV show, World's Worst Mom, airs on the Discovery Life channel. But before that, it's time for Jesse's World.
Police in Nashville arrested a man after they caught him in bed with a stolen lingerie store mannequin.
Let her go. She's real, I swear.
An assistant manager at the Hustler Hollywood store said that she saw the suspect, 55-year-old Christopher Wade, flee with the mannequin just after midnight. The employee said that she argued with the suspect, who was intoxicated, but she could not stop him from tossing the skimpy model into his truck. Police said that the mannequin lost her left arm as Wade fled the scene and that the suspect did not retrieve the arm. The employee told police that the mannequin is worth upwards of $5,000, outfit not included. Wade was charged with theft of property.
He's in love with a dummy.
Oh! Police are searching for answers after a burned body was found outside of a Michael's store in Florida Monday morning. Just before 7 a.m., a 911 caller told police that a mannequin was on fire just behind the store. When the fire department arrived, they realized that the mannequin was actually the body of a dead human being. The body was still burning when the fire department arrived. Ohio police say they believe they stopped a man's plotted armed assault on police officers with armed mannequins. Video surveillance shows 51-year-old Timothy Ward posing with one of the mannequins. Police also have several videos that Ward posted online with the mannequins. Police received a tip earlier this month that he was planning to have armed mannequins injure officers and blow up a police station. As the FBI and local agencies began investigating Ward on Tuesday, they searched his home. The chief said agents confiscated several armed mannequins. Ward was arrested on two counts of retaliation and a weapons charge. Police say Ward was released from community supervision last year and that they learned he had recently stopped taking his medication. For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
I don't even want to ask where and how, Jesse, but good job as always. And now we're going to Lenora Scanese, and we love to talk about just about everything on this show, as you know, history, sports, love and death, and public policy periodically. But parenting and family, we really love to get into and dig into, and especially when we can hear from the moms, who are usually on the front lines of the parenting wars, and sometimes those wars are just fake. And we're fortunate that the chief warrior for common sense, Lenora Scanese, joins us now. Lenora, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for that intro. Chief warrior for common sense, I like.
I like it, too. So tell us your personal story and your son's before we dig into the segment.
All right. The reason you're talking to me today is because when my younger son was 9 years old, he asked me and my husband if we would take him someplace he had never been before and let him find his own way home on the subway. We live here in New York City. We decided yes. One sunny Sunday, I took him to Bloomingdale's, fancy schmancy department store in a fancy schmancy neighborhood, and I said, okay, today's the day, and I went one way, and I left him to figure out the other way, which was in the subway. The subway is right underneath Bloomingdale's. He had to take the subway down a couple of stops, get out, and catch a bus across town, and when he came through the door of our apartment, he was levitating because he was so proud that he had finally been allowed to do something on his own that he felt ready for and that we allowed him to do. And I wrote a column about it and ended up on, I can't even remember, the Today Show, what is it? Today Show, MSNBC, Fox News, and NPR, 2 days later, being described as America's worst mom. And so that was it. That was the beginning of this crusade, I guess, that has been going on now. That son is 18, so it's been 9 years.
Well, congratulations, because, you know, when I was a kid, Lenore, I lived in Bergen County, New Jersey, about 10 miles straight as the crow flies from the George Washington Bridge. And on Saturdays, we would tell our parents at the age of about 11 or 12 that about 10 or 12 of us were going to bike across the bridge, go downtown, park our bikes, and tie them up around a Riverside Drive bike stand and go in and have a couple of hot dogs and wander around Central Park. And my parents said, have fun. That was it.
They let you do that? Okay, because I was just, that reminded me, I'm looking for George Washington Bridge on my site now, which is Free Range Kids. And I'll read you about another guy who went over that bridge. Here it is. Okay, boy 10, bikes 20 miles into New York City. This is a guy writing his little autobiography, and he wrote, he pedaled 20 miles down unfamiliar roads and busy streets past neighbors and strangers out into the unknown. I didn't need help from anyone. It took me all day, but I found the way, and I did it myself. He crossed over the George Washington Bridge. And he credits that with giving him the, I guess, the confidence and the sort of adventurous spirit that allowed him to go guess where?
Where?
the moon.
Yeah. Oh, just that? Oh.
Yeah, just that. That's Buzz Aldrin's autobiography, talking about taking his bike, going over the George Washington Bridge, and going into the city just like you.
Well,
you haven't gone to the moon, have you?
No, I haven't. But you know what? I've always been an adventurer. My parents courted it. They, in fact, insisted on it. And all the parents did. None of them hung around us. They basically said, go out. We'll see you in 12 hours because we got a life. We got a life.
We got a life, and you have a life. And what's interesting about it is that they were allowed to do it. I mean, what has taken me over into the policy side of life these days is hearing from so many parents, almost on a daily basis it's become, who are arrested or investigated for letting their kids have any unsupervised time. It's just, it's not allowed, even though our crime rate today is lower than when Buzz went to the moon. We're back to the crime rate of 1963,
yep,
which was before color television, before the moon landing, when gas was 29 cents a gallon. And when parents were allowed to put you and your friends on their bikes, not even put you on, obviously, just say goodbye, and let you have your adventures. And of course, if something untoward happened, you guys had to figure out how to get out of it. If you had a flat tire or you got lost, they trusted you to rise to the occasion, and that's something that we're not allowed to trust our kids to do anymore, which is a huge insult to that entire generation.
It really is, and thank you, Lenora, for setting the record straight, because I read this statistic in this poll the other day that people think New York City is more dangerous than ever, and yet simultaneously, in 1980-something, I'm not sure if it was 84 or 85, there were 2,000 murders in that city.
Right.
And this past year, there were like 320, making it one of the safest places to be in the world when you account that almost 10 million people live there.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because that's true.
It is true.
All I can say is that people constantly believe that, you know, Roper and Gallup do polls all the time, and they ask people, is crime going up or down? And the majority of people always say that it's going up, and they've been wrong since 1993 when it started turning around, and it's been coming down ever since.
Well, and having a 24-hour news cycle that just will take any local crime and turn it into a national trend would allow almost any parent to just be terrified or mortified. My answer, by the way, always, Lenore, is turn off your TV. Just turn it off.
Turn on your radio.
Yeah, exactly. Listen to this. So, Lenora, so that this happens, and you become the world's worst mom.
Yeah.
What was it like sitting on that set of the Today Show? I mean, did you feel? Did you know that's what they were going to have you on to discuss?
I was quite surprised. It was obviously my first time on the Today Show, and what I didn't realize that they would do is they asked, "Oh, could we have you on?" I said, "Okay." And then, "Could we have your son on?" "Sure, that sounds fun." And they said, "And we're going to have somebody else there who might want to comment." I was like, okay. But I didn't realize that someone else would be a child psychologist. You got to always worry about them. Actually, I don't worry about them. I think there are plenty of wonderful child psychologists.
Yep.
This is a TV child psychologist.
Right.
Worry about them. And that she would be sitting on the couch with me. And once I explained what we'd done and my kids said it was so fun, she said, well, there were safer ways you could have done the same thing, like following him without him knowing it, or have him going with a bunch of friends.
And
I was like, that's not the same thing.
That's not the same thing, you silly person. And when we come back, hold that thought, Lenore. We're talking to what I believe is one of the world's great moms, combating the world's worst mom tag by simply allowing her kids to do some things on their own. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We're talking to Lenora Skenazy, who's the author of the book and blog Free Range Kids. I love that title. And a contributor to Reason.com, and her TV show World's Worst Mom airs on the Discovery Life channel. And we now know why she was called World's Worst Mom. And for so many of us listening, It sounds like it's backwards, of course, that label. And we were talking about, Lenora, when we left off, just thought this whole idea of risk. In 2006, you said on NPR, 50 kids were abducted and killed in America. The whole country, 50, out of 75 million children. So in other words, Lenora, you're 40 times more likely to die in a car wreck, and yet parents won't leave their kids alone.
Right. Well, it always interests me when people say, like, oh, I could never let my kid walk to school or play outside or, you know, walk around the corner even because of the risk. And I'm not saying that there's no risk. I'm saying that there's very, very little risk. And frankly, there's nothing that carries no risk. And yet some things we just see only through the lens of what terrible thing could happen. And that's what we do when we let our kids have any unsupervised time. But as you just said, that basically the most risky thing you can do with your child at all in America these days is to put them in the car and drive them anywhere. And we don't, you know, scream at parents who put their kids and drive them to the dentist's office, what are you doing? What do you think about it? How would you feel if your child is dead? You know, you would feel so bad. But we do that whenever any parent lets their kid, you know, walk to school or play outside or go on an overnight. And it's because we've decided that parents are in constant control. And if the parents are with a child all the time, nothing terrible can happen. And the instant that they are not supervising their kid and their kid has a little taste of independence, even walking two blocks to school, that is foolhardy, because what happens if something terrible goes on?
Yeah, it's so true. We had on Greg Gipp, who's the economics editor for the Wall Street Journal, and we spent about 12 weeks with him because his book, Foolproof, and I think the subtitle is something like How Safety Makes Us Less Safe and How Danger Makes Us Safe. And it's very counterintuitive, but he really talks about how, look, you know, if you don't allow your kid to take calculated chances and risks and calculated ones, and the parents don't, how will this child be able to be out on his own in the world? How will he develop what I like to call an inoculation against life's ills? Talk about that.
What's interesting, though, is even when we start talking about calculated risk, you hear the word risk, and it sounds dangerous. You know, risk is inherent in all life. We interpret risk as risky.
Right.
And when you do that, then it starts saying, like, well, maybe my kid is ready for risk. You never want to send your kid out into real risk. So I don't even like using that word. I think it's like, when can you let your kid have a life? And the way I try to present it in the lectures I give is I ask the audience to break into little groups of, like, just, you know, three or four people, whoever is sitting near you, and I'll ask you to do this if there's anyone in the studio with you now, and think about, well, you actually told me this when we first got on, you know, something that you did as a child that you absolutely loved doing that you don't let your own kids do. And once people start thinking that way, it's like, oh, my God, yes, I played in the forest, we made forts, or I went to my friend's house, we played outside, we did manhunt at night with the streetlights on. You know, people remember all these things so fondly. It is the foundation of who they are, that confident kid with the communication skills and the imagination to come up with a new game. And to take that away from our kids is to take away something so precious. I mean, we're trying to give everything to our kids. We're trying to get them into a good school. We're trying to get them wonderful after-school activities. We're trying to make sure that they have, you know, a good vacation and some happy memories. And yet we're taking away the happiest memories from them by saying you can't have any time on your own. That's something that hits people when they start thinking of it that way, when they start realizing, like, wait a minute, I want to give my kid everything. And then I say, and you can give that to your kid because for the same reason that your parents gave that freedom to you. It's not that your parents thought that there was no crime in the world or that nothing could ever go wrong. It's that they trusted you, they trusted their community, and they recognized the importance of showing your kid, I believe in you, go out and play, not, I don't think you can handle anything, I'm going to be right next to you all the time.
Yeah, I think that's the big one. I think you said it best. I mean, my parents conferred tremendous trust in me. And they were also saying independence is good. I mean, it's a virtue. And they didn't have to ever say those words because
no,
they live
no, no.
those
it was,
words.
It was It was so obvious. I mean, that's what's so weird. It's like, what calculated risk? Well, let's, you know, contrast that with the entrepreneurial spirit that we're imbuing in our children with a modicum of freedom. It's like, no. It's like, kids, go out and play. And
right.
We all recognize that that was sort of the normal state of kids, that they'd have some chores and some school, and then the rest of the time they had to fill. And there's these two fears that are stalking Americans. One is that you send your kid outside and they'll be, you know, kidnapped and murdered. And the other fear is that you send your kid outside and they're not going to get the scholarship in soccer because you haven't had them in 5-day-a-week travel soccer. Or they're not going to ace their AP U.S. History exam because you haven't had them in AP U.S. History exam extra classes. And what is ironic is that when I went to the TED Talks and I spoke to the people who are heads of all these fantastic corporations, everything from, you know, Amazon to Skype, and I asked them about their childhoods, and of course they remembered, oh, you know, we accidentally set my room on fire because we were making rockets, or I went around, you know, gathering my friends and we would always have a ball game. They did not go to entrepreneur class. They went to play, and that was their training. That's what all kids need, is time on their own, figuring out what they're interested in, learning how to focus because they're so fascinated and they want to do that thing so much, and filling their time, figuring out who they are. Why would we take that away from kids?
Yeah, life class, I almost like to call it.
Life class, yeah, good.
And you know, the structure we're throwing on kids, Lenore, is really, it's distressing. I mean, the parents I know all look exhausted because they're ferrying kids around from here to here. Mm-hmm. If they play baseball, it's extreme baseball. They're playing all year long, and they're traveling far and wide. Look, I love basketball. My dad gave me a ball, and we had bicycles. And we would leave Little Dumont, New Jersey, and we would get on our bicycles, and we would go to Englewood, and we would play guys from there. Mm-hmm. And then we would drive home. That was it. There were no leagues. There were no super. I mean, it was just you get to high school, you play against the other schools. That's it.
Right. On the other hand, I do feel for kids and parents today because it is hard to find a group of kids playing outside that then can play with another group of kids. So I'm trying to do a couple of things to sort of renormalize kids outside playing with each other. And one thing I did is I started something called freerangefriend.com, where you go in, you put in your zip code, and you can find other people who also want to send their kids outside. I know that sounds a little calculated, but at least you have the same goal in mind, which is having your kids play outside. You don't care what they do. You just want them to go outside. So this is a way to find other kids in the neighborhood whose parents will let them go outside. And another thing I'm trying to do is get schools to start the Free Range Kids Project, which is the teachers tell the kids to go home and ask their parents if they can do one thing or another that they feel they're ready to do that for one reason or another they haven't done yet, whether it's walk the dog, make dinner, get themselves to school, you know, pick up their brother from soccer. And because it's endorsed by the school and because it's a one-shot deal, usually the parents, even the parents who have been overprotective, say, okay, yeah, you can go to the store and get some bread for that project that you're going to get extra credit for. And once the kid leaves the house by themselves and comes back with the bread, which they will do, it changes the parent completely, way more than a discussion by you and me of, you know, whither the entrepreneurial spirit and what are the odds of getting killed by a stranger versus killed in a car crash. Seeing your kid walk through the door elated that you believed in him, that he got to run an errand, that he brought the bed that you're going to eat tonight, that changes the parents. The parents are so proud that instead of saying, I'm not letting them do it, I'm too scared, they say, look what my kid can do. And so the Free Range Kids Project is simple, free, and transformative.
Well, we love the idea. By the way, always be careful of what you ask your kids to ask you. Because my little one, I take her out to L.A. to visit my dad. And my dad and I always go to Vegas. And we've taught her how to card count and play blackjack. And so she wants to go to Vegas and play blackjack on her own. And I said, look, you got to wait till you're 18, sweetie. But, you know, keep practicing. Keep practicing. She's 11.
Oh, so, boy, I think she'd take them by storm. Sounds great.
It is great. And, Lenore, thanks for doing this. And we got to make this a regular stop. Send us your material.
Okay.
This is terrific. And, by the way, if we can do one thing and let the parents out there know, A, it's okay to be thinking what we're thinking, and then let's get together because maybe we can just bring at least our own lives back to normal by meeting those parents who want to get our kids together and go off into the woods and play for a few hours. So maybe we could have a martini and talk about adult things without our kids hovering around us every nanosecond. Now, this is Lee Habib, and we've had on Lenora Skenazy for the last two segments and hopefully many more times. And we're talking about kids, and we're talking about parents, and we're talking about independence and why, in some ways, this culture is not engendering it. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College. And we are celebrating today's This Day in History because right now, the 103rd edition of the Tour de France is taking place, and there is only one American who has ever won this prestigious bike race. This is his story.
For anyone under the age of 40, or for those of you who didn't notice the sport of cycling until Lance Armstrong's miraculous comeback in 1999, it can be difficult to understand and believe how popular American cyclist Greg LeMond was, how significant his Tour de France victories felt, and how deeply he touched lives.
Backyard was like the Alps.
Get going, Cal.
I was wild and into the wild. When I was 8 years old, I discovered hiking, fishing, downhill skiing. Coaches said, you know, the best thing for skiing is cycling. I got to get a bike. Cycling was a counterculture sport. I kind of tend to not do what everybody else is doing. My dad bought one too. So we started riding together. There was magic to riding. Even by the end of August, we did a 100K ride, and my dad and I got to talk, and we were like best friends, like teammates.
His early career promised greatness. Here's Greg and his father, Bob.
I had a 76 Volkswagen van. We'd leave for the Bay Area or Southern California and race. They were amateur races, but Greg was doing very well.
I won my 11 races, and I'm bored. 16, 17 years old, I went to Europe by myself for 2 months with $75 in my pocket. Everybody had this mentality that Europeans are unbeatable. They're mythical, actually. They're like, they're from another planet. I'm thinking, those Tour de France winners have to start somewhere, just like me. Two races in Switzerland, two races in France, I won them. Went to Belgium, won 6 out of 8. That's when I wrote my 4 goals out.
This is written in October of 1978, which would have made him 17. Cycling goals. 79, win the Junior World Championship road race, which he did. 1980, win the Olympic road race. Not possible because of the boycott. By age 22, win Pro World Championships road race. Age 25, win the Tour de France.
And an enormous crowd on Alpe d'Huez now, and still Greg LeMond follows the wheel of his teammate Bernard Hinault.
There's something magic about the Tour. People talk about the Olympics, they go, that's nothing compared to the Tour as an event.
The two riders who have projected themselves without a shadow of a doubt as the two greatest riders in this year's Tour de France.
It's a Formula One Grand Prix, New York City Marathon, but doing that for 21 days and with 15 million people.
You've got an American going to possibly win the yellow jersey for the first time. Paul, this has been a Tour de France in the greatest tradition of the event before these days have gone.
It was the 1985 Tour de France Cycling Super Bowl, where 200 riders covered 2,200 miles in 3 weeks, that established Greg's legendary career. This incredible story was recently made into a movie for ESPN's 30 for 30 series called Slaying the Badger.
Phil, we have a chance to see perhaps an American winner here in Greg LeMond.
Absolutely, John, and really for the first time, Greg LeMond is now ready to win the Tour de France and add a little bit more history to this great sporting event. Of course, his main adversary is his own teammate, Bernard Hinault. He's the man that LeMond may well have to beat to get that final yellow jersey when the race ends in Paris.
You've got 22 teams, you've got 9 men on the squad. The unique character who wins the Tour de France has just about everything. It's very unlikely to be more than 5 guys with this unique ability. You've got to be able to climb mountains, you've got to be able to show the descending skills at 100 kilometres an hour, and above all, you've got to ride the individual time trials. We always call it the race of truth. It's you against the watch. And there aren't many riders got all that ability, so what they do is they choose a leader who they think have that ability, put him in as the leader of the team, and then the others are called the kitchen help. We call them domestiques. They'll come round you like a queen bee. Their job is to make sure their leader is in exactly the position when it matters to win the race, because they know he can do it and they can't.
The story in one paragraph goes like this. Greg's French teammate, Bernard Hinault, known as the Badger, had won 4 Tour de France's and, nearing the end of his career, wanted a 5th to equal the Tour record. The young LeMond was stronger.
Up front, the argument goes on. LeMond rebels against the team's instructions. He angrily attempts to persuade his coach that he should be given the chance to win the Tour.
But under pressure from his team and coach, he agreed to support Hinault rather than take his first victory.
Bernard Hinault, 5 Tour wins. The American story, of course, another historic one for Greg LeMond from Rochelle County, Nevada. A kiss from his wife, Kathy.
In return, Hinault promised to help LeMond win the Tour de France the following year.
You know, it's like, oh no, another repeat.
But the Badger reneged on his promise.
But everybody feels that Hinault is hiding something.
And repeatedly attacked LeMond during the race in attempts to win again.
LeMond knows now that he must take on Bernard Hinault and match him at his speciality.
But he failed.
LeMond has simply proved himself to be just too strong for the Badger.
Greg's first Tour de France win was achieved not only without the support of his coach and team, but also in the face of what many fans believe was outright hostility. It was a cowboy win, reckless and individualistic, and raging against the establishment. But it was the right move and a righteous victory. Because the race appeared at length on U.S. televisions, America responded. Here's Greg's father, Bob.
We got a telegram from Ronald Reagan, the president, and a letter from him, and Greg was invited to the White House, so it was pretty big in that sense.
It was really landmark in the history of the Tour, an American winning the Tour, because afterwards it brought more and more English speakers into the sport of cycling, and Lance Armstrong, you know, well, God bless him, wouldn't have existed without Greg LeMond, because all of a sudden the fact that Greg LeMond won the Tour, the world audience of the Tour changed completely.
And when we come back, more of this remarkable story, our This Day in History series continues. This is Our American Stories, and what a story. I did not know this story, and This was brought to us by Greg Engler, who is a cyclist himself, or was, a very competitive one. Actually, I don't think Greg wouldn't be competitive in almost anything he does. We have a contest about who he can eat the most cherries. So there's another side of this story, and there's more to it. And as always, our This Day in Histories are brought to us by Hillsdale College. And it's the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. And where we left off, Lamon had won what was called a cowboy victory without his team, without his mentor, but he'd won it, the first American ever to win this coveted award. He made the cover of Sports Illustrated, by the way, for this, and was named their Sportsman of the Year, a first also for a cyclist. But what happened next? Let's take a listen.
We are choosing to celebrate this day by looking back at the greatest year in the Tour de France's 100-plus year history, and the American man that made it so.
And now the proudest moment for Greg LeMond. His name in French means the world, and this is the world of Greg LeMond in Paris today, the first American ever to pull on a winner's yellow jersey in the Tour de France.
But less than a year after Greg's first Tour de France victory, this happened.
There's turkey hunting in the United States, and turkey hunting is a spring season. I just backed into berry bushes. I was sitting there and I wanted to look and see where everybody was. And when I stood up, my brother-in-law happened to be up behind it. So he shot at the first thing that moved, and that was me. The crazy thing, it didn't hurt. I didn't know it, but my uncle said I had a stream of blood from my neck, just pulsating out a steady beat.
They called a helicopter, and the helicopter pilot ended up taking him to UC Davis Medical Center.
He saved my life. If I would have had to go by ambulance, I'd have been dead. I had pellets, about 50 of them, and probably 20 of them went right through me. And I still have 35 in me, you know, two in my heart, three in my liver.
And there's no way they can remove them?
No. I have chronic lead poisoning. It bothers me. So the more I ride now at this age, the worse I get.
Greg took what should have been a career-ending 2 years off from cycling.
You come back and race in the 1989 Tour de France.
After 2 years of absolute hell, I went in the Tour, an underdog, everybody wrote me off. I was racing against a very strong Fignon who won two Tour de France before that.
Greg would win the stage, Fignon would win the stage. Greg would take yellow, Fignon would take yellow. It was just, every day was a great story. And then we got to about 4 days to go, and Fignon was now 50 seconds ahead of Greg LeMond.
Day before the final race, he tapped me on the shoulders and he said, congratulations on your second place. Now, he and I were teammates and the same coach. And that coach told us and taught me, the race is never over until the finish line, no matter what. It's never over till the finish line. You never take it for granted. And when he did that, I said, uh-oh, you've lost the race.
At the beginning, it's advantage Fignon. He will start last wearing the leader's yellow jersey. He chases LeMond along the course 2 minutes back. He'll know all the way exactly what time Greg LeMond is doing.
Probably shouldn't say this. You wrote your story, and you wanted to turn it in quickly and then get out of there.
Back on to the banks of the River Seine, the Eiffel Tower is now looming large on the right shoulder of Laurent Fignon.
So I wrote my story, you know, Laurent Fignon withstood challenge by Greg LeMond.
You can almost see the difference in the speed, Phil. It's incredible to watch LeMond here. What do you think of this man? He's still got pellets in his back from that shooting accident.
It was Fignon coming up Champs-Élysées.
40 seconds deficit for Laurent Fignon.
Everybody's screaming, and you realize at some point before he made the turn, he had lost.
The gap is 48 seconds, Phil. This is the most incredible thing I think I've ever seen in my life. 26:57, he goes into soft
lane. There was this universal cry of
the crowd has realized it. Laurent Fignon has lost the Tour de France by 8 seconds.
He was this great story dropped in our laps, and all anybody could think of was, I'm not going home.
I never knew it would affect him so much. I mean, I've learned stuff since then. In the 20-plus years after that, he'd never gone to the Champs-Élysées. in his mind, he would be walking to get the mail, and he'd count 1,001, 1,002, 1,008 seconds. I lost by 8 seconds. I just said, hey, Laurent, you've won two, now I've won two, and we can see next year who'll get the third.
In 1990, LeMond won his third Tour de France. He looked certain to equal the Badgers' record of 5 wins. But the sport of cycling was about to change dramatically.
LeMond in 30 minutes behind the leaders. He quits the race right there.
By 92 is when I really became aware of it. Some of the riders looked like it was just a natural progression, or they explained it by weight loss. God, you look back at it, and it was all lies.
Here's Greg's teammate, Andy Hampston.
I saw EPO come in. It made phenomenal physiological changes. Could increase blood levels by 20%. I watched individuals and then groups of individuals and entire teams mop the floor with me and everyone else who I knew wasn't doping.
Here's Greg on Lance Armstrong.
Now loses it to Lance Armstrong here by 7. History's almost repeated.
Absolutely remarkable. But look at the face on Armstrong there. He's come here on a mission. He wants.
I bought into the story too with Lance coming back. He had 7 victories. Floyd Lamentis won one, so there are 8 American victories.
As Landis gets off his bike like he's about to deliver the newspaper.
It's a pretty impressive streak there for the Americans. But it wasn't real. That's the sad part.
His fairy tale just goes on and on.
He's got the support of the cancer community, the sponsors, fanatic fans, and I knew it could be suicide, whatever I said. I don't know who I said it to, but I said it's unbelievable. That's all I said. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
LeMond's most notorious remark was, if Lance is clean, it is the greatest comeback in the history of sports. If he isn't, it would be the greatest fraud. His funniest, with the drugs they have these days, one could convert a mule into a stallion. Greg LeMond is now the only American winner of the Tour de France. A lot of cyclists and Americans thought Greg LeMond was jealous of Armstrong. We now know better. Armstrong has been stripped of his Tour victories. This has given many all over the world an even deeper appreciation for what the only American winner of the Tour de France accomplished.
And great job on that, as always, Greg. And obviously, this one was personal to you. What did Greg LeMond mean to you as a cyclist?
Kind of the same thing that Wayne Gretzky did. He just meant just a positive image, a family guy, a guy you wanted to be like. I write my signature today because the way Greg wrote it when I was a kid, I just wanted to be him, not just as a cyclist, but what I saw in his face when he was off the race course. And he just was a guy that you wanted to be.
Well, and you know, coming around at that time with all the drugging, what a conundrum for an athlete. I mean, if everybody's doing it, and pretty much a new generation came, and it turns out a whole bunch of athletes were doing it, and he just chose not to, and in the end, he lost, and he knew that's why he lost, and yet he couldn't actually tell the world specifically why, and that just had to be torture for the guy.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a friend who is probably the top American racer right now, took 10th in the Tour de France twice, Andrew Tilansky. And he said, if I was presented with that, he's like, all of my team have discussed it and we probably would have went along. So for somebody to have that kind of character to just say, forget it, I'm not doing it, I can't imagine it.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And as always, are this days in history brought to you by Hillsdale College. Go to our website, ouramericannetwork.org. Click on the This Day in History segments. I think there are close to 100 now, and it's everything from sports to business leaders. The Alexander Hamilton, we're coming up on the celebration of his anniversary, and what a life. And we have Ron Chernow telling that life story because he wrote the book upon which the play was based and why we now have Hamilton Mania. A terrific read, a hell of a life story, and so is this one, Greg LeMond's. What an American story, and what a story about the very thing that David McCulloch likes to write about all the time, and that's character. And if Greg LeMond had anything aside from talent, it was character. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and in May, for National Foster Care Month, we brought you a lot of uplifting stories, and some really tragic ones, too. And that's what we do here, even on Father's Day. For every really positive Father's Day story we did, we had to tell the story of young men and women who did not have a father, whose father walked out or didn't do what he was supposed to do. And because that's what we do here in Our American Stories, we tell stories as they lay and as they lie. And one of the most amazing was with the team at the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, who specialize in finding homes for so-called unadoptable children. Go to ouramericannetwork.org to hear about the great work they're doing that changed so many lives for the kids, and I think more importantly, for the families adopting those kids. And Dave Thomas is the founder of Wendy's Restaurants and also the Adoption Foundation bearing his name. And today we bring you the following story and the following people. One of Wendy's franchisees, Ed Anderson, is doing something incredible and possibly some would think a little bit crazy to honor Dave's memory. Ed has been training for months so that he can ride his bicycle from Newport News, Virginia, all the way to San Diego, California. And this is a family affair. Ed's wife, Judy, well, she's the sensible one in the family. She'll be driving the vehicle next to him. They plan to make 21 stops along the 4,000-mile trip to visit fellow Wendy's franchisees and raise $1 million for the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. Ed and Judy, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
By the way, these are the stories, folks, that we love to bring to the American public because this is what Americans do. Wild, zany, and decent things for the sheer heck of it because, well, that's what we should be doing. Ed, tell us a little bit about your life and what brought you here, a little bit about your childhood and the different jobs you had leading up to your association with the Wendy's people.
I'd be happy to. I grew up in New Jersey, and I spent 3 years early in my life in Dunn, North Carolina. And we moved back to New Jersey in middle school, and I always said that I wanted to return to the South. So I went to college in Greensboro, North Carolina, and it's a small school called Guilford College, and that's where I met my wife. She was in the dish room, and I worked in the dish room. And so we met then, and then after college, I did not want to move back north. I wanted to stay in the South, partly and mostly because of my soon-to-be wife. So I took a job working for Wendy's International, and I spent 10 years working for the company and worked very hard at that position, and then after 10 years, because of Dave's philosophy of rewarding people with hard work, I was able to become a franchisee, and I've done that for the last 26 years, and it's been very successful. And this is my way of giving back, something small to give back to Dave, who was also adopted. So I thought that I would take this bicycle trip to raise funds and awareness for the DTFA and Wendy's Wonderful Kids.
And it's amazing what Dave and one human being can do for so many people, because this man gave you a pathway to a way to provide for your family and then in a way to then help others. And he proved to everybody around him that this is what commercial activity can do when it properly serves a purpose other than profit. I mean, obviously, Wendy's is not a charity. It's there to make money and serve its customers. But there's a mission beyond the mission, and that's a beautiful thing. Judy, a little bit about your life and what led you to be the person following your husband around. By the way, did you say, are you nuts, or were you just instantly like, I'm there with you, my friend, I'm there with you?
Oh, you know, love. That's what it's all about, right?
Yes, indeed.
And it's love. It's the passion that Ed has. It's for the cause, you know? I mean, sure, his end goal is to raise funds for the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, and we're encouraging everyone to contribute to this cause, such a worthy cause. But, you know, when I met Ed when I was 15 years old, back in the dish room, we met around food. 36 years now with Ed's, you know, relationship with Wendy's. 36 years, we're still food and love. That's what it's about. But, you know, my parents, they met together when they were 12 years old, in an orphanage as well. So not only is it Ed and my love for my husband, such a remarkable man, taking on this awesome adventure, and I'm at his side. And it's also, you know, to honor my parents as well, who also had so much love in their hearts and love for kids. And so we're just passing it on. That's what it's all about. Zany, yeah, crazy, but hey, I'm with this guy each and every mile, each and every step. So he can do it. He's going to be amazing at it.
And when did you first learn about the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption? Ed?
Dave formed this years and years ago, and as a Wendy's franchisee, you know, I've known about it, you know, since he worked very hard. He went to Congress, in fact, to help improve the laws to help people be able to adopt and get the same rights as, you know, people that are actually having their own child. You know, Dave, one of Dave's mantras, and as you said, Wendy's, you know, yes, we're there to make a profit, but Dave always said it's very important to give back, and that's why I'm doing this. And one of the things that Dave, when he spoke to Congress and to others, you know, he talks about the fact that, you know, these kids, 130,000 kids are in foster care. He said, these kids aren't somebody else's problem. They're ours. And so, you know, the DTFA has been very strong. Every year when we go to convention, franchisees and suppliers and distributors give generously towards the DTFA. And it's just something that's ingrained in every franchisee and in the company personnel. And it just proves the legacy that Dave has, you know, since 1969 when he started the company.
Well, and it's great to have a mission outside of profit for a company and for a family, by the way. I don't understand why families don't do these kinds of things too, because it brings everyone together in very, very beautiful and compelling ways. What are you going to do in these 21 communities, by the way, you're visiting along the way, Judy?
What am I going to do? I'm going to make a lot of friends. I do know that, you know, because they're going to be curious, and we're just going to continue to spread the mission and the word that what Ed is doing, his goal, and just the encouragement. That's what we all need in this world. And seeing the kids along the way, seeing their smile, seeing the parents, and you know what? Maybe sparking that idea, hey, I can help out. So I can't wait. I'm as excited as Ed is.
Well, maybe you guys can call us from the road. Ed, what are your physical preparation? What does your physical preparation look like for this trek? Are you ready? Are you in shape? You got game?
Oh, yeah.
I'm ready.
Good.
We don't want to hear that you've passed out somewhere in El Paso and had to be shipped back on a gurney. This would not be good, Ed.
No, there are a lot of people that are saying to be careful with that. But since I decided 100% to do this, which was probably in September, October of last year, you know, I've been bicycling. The wintertime was brutal because you got to bicycle inside. And I got to tell you, on a stationary bike, biking for 2 hours is boring.
Oh, what a grind.
But Yeah. Now that the weather's better, I've been outside. Of course, it's been really hot, but I'm getting used to that. So my bicycle rides can range from a short one of 30 to 80 miles in training. So, you know, I'll do those rides and get ready, and I feel like I'm ready. And now it's just a matter of let's go ahead and do this. And July 26th is when I do leave from the oceanfront in the Virginia Beach area. I'm going to dip my back tire in the Atlantic. And hopefully on October 4th, I'll dip my front tire in the Pacific.
Well, we need you to call along the way. And what can our folks do to give? Where can they reach out to? What's the website?
Well, I will call in, and the website is Ed's Bicycle Tour. And on there, you can find the website to donate directly to the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. And I appreciate everybody helping to find kids a forever home.
You betcha. And thanks so much. Ed, call us. Judy, call us. And we want to hear your progress. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories, and we've been bringing you highlights from a really good series called Comeback, which follows, of all people, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan around the country. And we don't do this too often, talk about politicians. And the only time we'll talk about them is when they're doing things that politicians don't normally do. And this is definitely something politicians don't normally do. And we don't care which politician's doing things that they don't normally do. We'll follow him around. And he's meeting folks who are overcoming real adversity. There's no politics, by the way, in the Comeback series. It's just stories. And Ryan's journey of taking a firsthand look at deep poverty in America is as riveting as what Bobby Kennedy did in the mid to late 1960s and what it did to his heart when he started to visit places like the Mississippi Delta. And he saw how disconnected some people were from work and from family and from American life. And now we bring you the highlights of episode 3, which is set in Dallas, Texas.
If your community was under siege by gangs, who would you call? More police? More social workers? Or how about some of the most aggressive and dangerous gang members ever to run the streets? That's certainly a less obvious and a less politically safe choice, but it's exactly what Texas did when it asked Omar Jawar for help.
I was the first person hired as a gang specialist for the state of Texas. I was working in the prison. It was at the height of the gang conflict. My job was to figure out resocialization solutions to get them to agree to peace. I would then furlough those young men and take them home. And I would go and ask the gang affiliates to allow them safe passage back into their neighborhoods. I did this deal called the Umoja Council, where the leaders of the sets and the cliques would mediate the conflict. So I taught them how to mediate and use their skills rather than their hands.
Jawar, the juvenile offender turned pastor, also takes his work to the schools and to the streets, mentoring whoever he meets, being a father to the many without fathers, in hope of keeping them from going down the same bad roads he did and ending up behind bars. He gives them hope to live by. The gangs of LA
will never die. See, it's nothing like being hopeful that you can make it, man. That somebody's with me. I'm not in this by myself. That gives you the ability to go places that you never thought you could go.
And Omar's not alone. He's built an army of former gang members to join his battle.
They are the soldiers. So if you're going to fight a war, you better recruit some soldiers.
You need a resilient army to take on a destructive army. So tell me, what have you left me? What have I got? Last night in Co-
cold blood, my young brother got shot. My homeboy got jacked, my mother's on crack. My sister can't work cause her arm show tracks.
It is guerrilla warfare. It is one-on-one.
We going in their neighborhoods, meeting them where they at. You know, bringing them to where they need to be.
Your methodology has to be closer than the normal social architect.
I know that child is not my son. Yeah. Son, how you doing? Talk to me. What's wrong?
Yeah.
So you have a social service person who says, I'm going to call you, Johnny, when you get home. And then we're going to make sure you get to school. Well, these guys say, no, I'm going to go home with you.
When this guy, he trying to put that dope in that young man or that young girl's hand, and we like, hey, man, we ain't got to tell him too many times.
Let's meet some of those soldiers.
Anton, he started the Bloods in Dallas.
We made a vow that we'll be the ruthless, most feared gang in the city.
Terrence, he's been shot 3 times point-blank range. They call him Maniac.
All of us are prominent in the neighborhood as we come up out of it.
You got Bobby, the guy who organized those guys who became the most dangerous and feared clique in our city.
We thought that was the way of life. And we didn't have anyone to teach us better.
Why would these guys join Omar's army when there's only one kind of life, one kind of army that they've ever known? And it's certainly not this.
These guys are not with me because I can pay them more than a drug gang. What would make them say, I'll yield my power to your cause? It's trust.
If I knew stuff I knew now back then, I would want a whole different direction, man.
And trust is something that only comes when both individuals are vulnerable to the issue.
I can see that boy from the hood, everybody like, well, he used to do this, he used to smoke, he used to do this, and that look right here. He got his own company, he got his own business, take care of his family.
I got to convince them that there's more redeeming value in giving something to somebody who absolutely can give nothing to you. And I told them, if you give me a shot, I can at least introduce you to the public with a new identity. Right now, you are feared, and right now, you are loathed. Right now, you are dismissed, and I believe you got a chance to become a hero.
Omar's army is stronger than the opposing one because they're soldiers who figured this out.
There were some brothers who were trying to challenge Tim to a fight. And Tim said, now, we can fight, but before we do this, I want to just tell you that I was the boxing champ in prison. I just want to let you know, but we still can fight now. I just want to be honest before we get into this. And the brothers started negotiating with Tim. And Tim said something that Bob says all the time. He said, I'm glad that both of us are hard enough to be soft.
A man comes in peace because he can't fight. He's likely to get beaten. But if a man who can inflict tremendous violence chooses not to, and chooses peace, that gets people's attention, even in the hardened places that they work.
In Pleasant Grove, there are more deaths in that zip code than in Iraq during the war.
A lot of kids coming up in single-parent homes, especially young men, they don't have that authority figure.
Got hold of weapons at a young age. We in the hood.
It's just a free-for-all that has said individual survival.
You know, they always talk about it takes a village to raise a kid. But what happens if the village is sick?
Most of these children suppress their gifts because they have to play a role to fit in this culture.
They turn to the streets. They turn to the drug dealer for a role model.
So in the process of living up to this, you got to go to prison or you got to get killed.
You're going to either be down with us or we're going to beat you up. And so that kid has to transform and be somebody else just to survive.
Pressure for a child who wakes up and says, this is my reality.
They got 1 foot in and 1 foot out, and they're about to go the wrong way.
It really is difficult for you to become a positive, vibrant, resilient person because this environment snatches it from them so quick. So someone comes and say, hey, man, you need to smile. They say, for what? There's a life aisles down to a grind, man, and it's a hell of a grind to live in that neighborhood, live in that institution, live in that environment without anybody giving you hope. That is very hurtful. That's
That's why you got to have people who remind those in this trap that it's not permanent and that you have the ability to get out.
One of Omar's army's most powerful weapons in this war is that it's personal to them. Personal in a way that it could never be for a government bureaucrat.
It's our community. We live here. So it's either we gonna build or destroy.
It's comeback time. Episode 4 next week.
And great job on that, guys. And that's why we did this story. As we told you, that ain't your typical political story. And Omar's army, oh my goodness. I love when he said, you know, you're feared, when he was talking to some of his gangbanger friends, you're feared, you're loathed, and you're dismissed. But you can be a hero. You guys have never heard anything like that. And by the way, using their masculinity to be heroic as opposed to terrorizing their neighborhoods. And never knowing there was an option. There was not an alternative to use their masculinity for good. And again, this is what happens when there are no fathers. We dig into this theme again and again and again. And you can't do it enough, actually. The consequences of no fathers. And great work, Congressman Ryan, and any other congressmen who want to go to the streets and do this kind of work and put some videos together. We don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, a Libertarian, Independent. We don't care if you're Bernie Sanders. We don't care if you're Hillary Clinton. Go do this. And my goodness, a private solution to a public problem. And who do you think the kids are going to respect? The guy's nickname was Maniac. Oh my goodness. You earn that nickname on the tough streets of inner cities or in hollows around this country and rural America where meth labs and gangs of a very different sort are starting to emerge all over this country. And again, it's not a black or white thing. In the end, it's about no fathers. And where there are no fathers, there will be gangs. And where there will be gangs, oh my goodness, no good comes of it. This is Our American Stories, and we love to bring you these redemptive stories because they're everywhere in the country. They are not covered. They are not reported. And we, against all odds, believe that you want to hear this. In fact, we know you want to hear this. If you're a human being, how could you not? More after these messages.